staff and faculty who have been impacted by sexual violence and misconduct. The SVSPO is a welcoming place where you can access support without judgment or assumptions. We work from a survivor-centered perspective, using an empowerment and trauma-informed approach that considers individual situations and perspectives. Please reach out. Services are located at the Diamond Alumni Center, room 014 on the lower level. Please reach out by email at sv-support@sfu.ca. That was sv-support@sfu.ca.
If you want to explore unique perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media, you are listening to the right channel. This is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Today on Wings, a guest from Canada discusses revitalizing Indigenous law for land, air, and water.
One of the things that I'm really excited about this is it's innovative, but it's also really ancient. And, you know, some people would consider this area of law to be sort of cutting edge.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
I'm Frieda Worden. My guest is Maxine Mattelpy.
My name is Maxine Mattelpy, and I'm the project manager for RELAW at West Coast Environmental Law. And RELAW stands for Revitalizing Indigenous Law for Land, Air, and Water. So that's who I am in the work world. But I am also in my tribal affiliation. I'm Kwagilt from Northern Vancouver Island. And my other name is Lakwalokwa, which means calling the people to feast with her. So that's my Kwakwala name that came from my grandmother. And it's a name that I carry with sort of almost trepidation because she was such a beautiful person. And I try my best to call her into the space whenever I say her name or think of her name.
So this area of Indigenous law, what's your experience with law?
I have two law degrees, so I have a regular law degree, and then I have a master's in law, and I've worked as a lawyer. But I was practicing Aboriginal law, which is really different than Indigenous law, which is what I'm doing now. So Aboriginal law, just to get really clear on the difference, Aboriginal law, that's like the law of Canada. That's the law of the state. That's, you know, the Constitution and the Indian Act and Section 35 and Aboriginal and treaty rights. So that's Aboriginal law, but that's not what I'm doing now. What I'm doing now is I'm working with Indigenous law, the laws that are of the Indigenous people themselves, the ancient laws. So that's an important distinction, the distinction between Aboriginal law and Indigenous law.
Is there a conflict between Aboriginal law and Indigenous law?
Oh, that's such a good question. Somebody could write a PhD on that. Seriously, that's such a great question. So there is this thing that we call legal pluralism, and that kind of recognizes that there can be more than one law standing side by side. So there doesn't have to be a conflict, but there are differences. And I always like to remember that Canada is what we call a multi-juridical country. And that means that we have more than one system of law. And people recognize that we have the common law, and common law also would include Aboriginal law. And then in Quebec, they have the civil law. But often people forget that we also have Indigenous law.
So common law, now a lot of people, especially our listeners in the U.S., don't even know what common law is.
So common law, if I remember correctly from my law school many, many years ago, basically comes from England, and it's the law of precedent. So you rely on older decisions to help you make decisions about a current question. I think it was the Vanderpeet case. probably around 1998, where the Chief Justice of Canada said that, she's for the Supreme Court of Canada, she said, there is this golden thread of Indigenous law that can be traced back. But in the work that I'm doing and with the people that I work with, we like to think of Indigenous law can just stand on its own. It doesn't need to rely on the common law or Aboriginal law for its recognition. It can stand on its own. And partly, I think this is really an interesting thought, that if we rely on the common law to recognize Indigenous law, it's kind of like using the master's tools, and we know we can't dismantle the master's house with the master's tools. So we really like to think of Indigenous law being, you know, able to stand on its own.
All right. So how do you know what Indigenous law is?
Well, in the project that I'm doing, we look at several sources of Indigenous law, but mostly we are using stories, ancient stories, to look for principles of law within the stories. And because the project involves environmental law, we're looking for principles that are specifically around the environment. But that means we look in the stories to see who are the decision makers and how decisions are made and how conflicts are resolved. And we start off with published stories, but we also know that there are many other sources of Indigenous law. So, for example, there might be principles of law embedded in ceremony or in songs or dances, or, you know, it could be on the land itself, like watching nature. That can be a source of Indigenous law, or it could be what we call positivistic. So that's when, you know, there's one person who says, this is our law, and sort of pronounces what the law is. But we like to, for this project that I'm on, we're mostly using stories, but we do use other sources of Indigenous law. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about stories. Let's talk about an example of a story and how you find or what you find of law in it.
Okay, I'm trying to think of a specific example that I could summarize. My head is so full of them.
Is there a story that is short that you could read?
Yeah. It's two pages. So this story is called Atinmit and Biodiversity. It's told by Umik, who was actually one of my teachers back when I was a student at Vancouver Island University. So Dr. Richard Atlio includes this story in his book, Sawak, A Nuchanal Worldview. Atinmit had one more task that would change the appearance, if not the commonality, of the life forms of the world. In those days, there were no animals as we know them today. There were only people. Without contradiction, these were raven, deer, wren, woodpecker, wolf, eagle, grizzly bear, salmon, skate, dogfish, loon, crane, and so on. In those days, too, there were people who could foretell the future. The prophetic word had been given that someone is coming to change people into something else. Everyone wondered about this prophecy, and the great chiefs, wren, eagle, woodpecker, and grizzly bear, held council. After much thought and discussion, they decided that they did not want to be changed into something else. Moreover, they decided to kill anyone that tried to change them. The people began to make ready and to fashion weapons. Upon Atinmit's return to the earth, he found Raccoon carving a beautiful club with many designs. With a friendly smile, Atinmit approached. He'd been gone for so long that he was now a perfect stranger. He saw that Raccoon was almost finished. "Ah, you have a beauty there," Atinmit said. "Raccoon, what are you making?" "It's a club," Raccoon said proudly. "Oh, ah, yes, it's for the one who's coming to change people into something else. Oh, ha, but if he tries anything with me, wham, I'll get him with my club." "Here, let me see it," Atinmit said. "Ah, it's beautiful, very beautiful. Here, turn around, Raccoon. I think it would look nice right here." Then Atinmit placed the club on Raccoon's backside, slapped him there, and said, "Go, henceforth, you shall be Raccoon." Away scampered Raccoon as an animal. As Atinmit walked on, he soon came upon Deer making two knives from seashells. "What are you doing?" Atinmit smiled. "Oh, I'm making knives," Deer said. "Ah, that is fine workmanship," Atinmit declared. "Ah," Deer paused to admire his own handiwork. "I'm preparing for the one who's coming to change people into something else. I like me exactly the way I am. No one is going to change me." "Ah, let me see those," Atinmit said. Deer was flattered by the stranger's interest and handed the knives over. "Those would look very pretty on your head," Atinmit smiled. "Ha, that will do." And with that, Atinmit slapped Deer on the backside and declared, "Go, henceforth you shall be Deer." And away Deer bounded into the forest. And that is how Atinmit made every manner of animal and life form that inhabits the earth today. Each weapon he admired flattered each person to whom it belonged. To each he said, "Go henceforth, you shall be." Thus today we have wolves, deer, bears, raccoons, ravens, eagles, and all the rest of creation. So what we would do with a story like this is we do this thing that we call case briefing, which is the same thing that law students and judges do. We start off by talking about what are the important facts, who are the decision makers, and how are decisions made, and what are the reasons. It's quite a long process, and I'm not going to do it here, but embedded in this story is how the decisions are made. So in the story, we learn that the great chiefs, the wren, eagle, woodpecker, and grizzly bear, come together and hold a council. And after much thought and discussion, they decide that they don't want to be changed. You know, you might even say it was like democracy, a deliberative democracy, because it's not just one person making a pronouncement. So that would be one principle that would come out of a story like this. But what we do with this project is it's not just one person deciding what this is. It would be maybe one person would read the story and case brief it and pull out some important principles. And then together, just like in the story, we get together and work with other people to see what they get out of the story. And then they would take it back to the community. So this story comes from the Nuchanos people on the west coast of Vancouver Island. So they would take it back to the community and through community dialogue, talk about the story and make sure that we've got it right. You know, maybe they would say, "Oh, that's a one-off. You know, like, we don't always hold council. That story is an anomaly." Or like, "Oh, yeah, that's what we do all the time." So we consider it really important to do these dialogue sessions. And when I say we, it's not we as the lawyers at West Coast Environmental Law that are doing this work of case briefing with stories. It's we have researchers in communities that are doing the work. So people who are, you know, really familiar with the language and familiar with the significance maybe of raven or deer or wolf or, you know, other stories that would connect to some of the important points that are within this story.
So once the story is discussed, are there decisions made about it? And then how is that information processed by the people?
Yeah, so for each of the communities that we're working with, and right now we're working with six communities. Last year we worked with a different six communities. Each of the communities has some important project that they want to do. So it was really interesting that last year a lot of the communities wanted to protect water. So when they were working with the stories, they focused on water and on principles that came from the stories to protect water. So one of the communities wanted to write up a water policy that would guide their community and others, anybody that came in and wanted to do something that would affect water or use water. They wanted to pull out principles that could be useful for helping to make those decisions. We've had other communities work on wildlife policy, you know, how to protect animal habitat, or marine protection was another one. And so it was pulling principles out of stories and then creating sort of contemporary legal instruments out of those principles from within the stories.
On Wings, you're listening to Frieda Worden's interview with Maxine Mattelpy, Program Manager of the ReLaw Project in British Columbia, Canada. ReLaw's first step is to search a community's traditional sources for principles that apply to environmental governance. Next, that community dialogues to draft written law, policy agreement, or plans. Maxine Mattelpy describes one early result.
One of the best examples I've seen is the work that was done by the Tsleil-Waututh people. So the Tsleil-Waututh people are in the area that will be affected if the Kinder Morgan pipeline goes through. They did their own assessment because they felt that the assessment that was being done by government wasn't good enough. So they use principles of law from their stories to pull out legal principles that were about that marine environment.
Do you have some of the principles in mind?
Well, it's a huge document, but there's one really small thing. It's a small thing, but in my mind, it's huge. One of the principles they talk about in their assessment is about the importance of doing ceremony with water. And the water has to be clean and healthy water. So they can't do their ceremony if they don't have clean and healthy water. That, for me, is one of the most beautiful statements that I've seen around Indigenous law. What that would mean if there was an oil spill in those waters of Burrard Inlet, water where they want to do those ceremonies that they need to live their law.
Since this interview took place, the Kinder Morgan pipeline became the Trans Mountain Pipeline. It was purchased and completed by the Canadian government. In addition, the Canadian Supreme Court ruled against a BC First Nation that had fought against a ski resort on their sacred mountain. Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin wrote that freedom of religion only applied to freedom of belief, not freedom of practice. Undaunted, the ReLaw Project is in its eighth year. Again, project lead Maxine Mattelpy.
Again, I think it goes back to that question of legal pluralism. And we hear a lot of talk about reconciliation in this country. You know, people talk about how this land is haunted. We're haunted by our history, about the way Indigenous people and Indigenous lands have been treated through colonization. And that one of the ways of healing all of that trauma is through implementation of Indigenous laws. So there is conflict, but I do think that it's possible for the two laws to work together, you know, Indigenous law and an Aboriginal law, or the law of Canada. I think that there are ways for those two systems to work together and ways that would benefit everyone. You know, I think some of those principles that I've seen, especially the ones around water, the way that some communities that I've worked with see water like as a loving, kind grandfather, you know, like that's your ancestor, that we came from that. And so how do you treat that? You treat it with love and respect and care, and you don't mess with it. So I think that there are principles that would help the country as a whole to heal, that are good for everyone and for all beings, Indigenous people, non-Indigenous people, animals, plants, and the land itself.
I don't doubt that, and I think a lot of people have their hopes on Indigenous people to come up with some alternative way of dealing with the world.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's so true. And, you know, in some ways it's this great, almost a burden, because I've seen, just last week in some of my work, I was taken up to a hunting camp by one of the communities that we're working with, and to see the heartache that they experience when they see the destruction of their land because of the placer mining that's going on up in their community, just the total destruction of waterways and beaver dams. And we saw a caribou, and it was this magnificent animal in this beautiful, pristine place. But then right next to it is placer mining, that it's like this giant scar on the land. And the people there, you can tell it's really hard for them to see that. And so when I think about the possibilities for this work, I think we're all kind of facing this grief that we see of what's going on in the planet. You know, Indigenous, non-Indigenous people are facing up to this grief around the incredible destruction of land and water and the climate. And I do see Indigenous law as an opportunity for hope and healing, but I feel like we can't do the work fast enough. You know, we're a really small group of people. There are, I think, maybe 6 or 8 lawyers working on this project, and we're this small nonprofit firm, and there are other people doing the work too, and there are academics doing the work. But the work that we're doing at West Coast Environmental Law is quite innovative in that, you know, we're taking these principles and we're not just doing this kind of academic exercise. We're actually trying to use the principles to make government and industry pay attention.
Yeah.
I've never felt like this in other legal work that I've done. Like, my head and heart for once are totally lined up. I feel like I'm in the right place. And yeah, it's pretty amazing to be doing this stuff.
Describe one of the communities that you have worked in, if you would.
Well, most recently, I was up in Atlin, which is in northwest part of BC, close to the Yukon, working with the Taku River Tlingit people. And there's about 150 people that live there on the reserve that's at one end of the little town of Atlin. But it's surrounded by these big high mountains and glaciers, this incredibly beautiful territory. And the people so far that I've worked with seem very connected to both the land and the animals. They seem to get a lot of their power from the animals. In fact, one of the stories that I first read up there involved encounters with animals where people are asking the animal for strength and power and to be kept safe, you know, not to be harmed from the animal. I don't mean like that, but just, you know, as I go through life, give me what I need, almost like a prayer to an animal. So they have this beautiful connection with animals. And I had this wonderful experience. I was up there with another lawyer, and the two of us were in this meeting, and we were meeting with community members, and this one guy who looked like he had just come in from working on the land, and he looked at us and he said, he said, you have to get out there on the land. It was kind of like he was telling us, like, how can you sit here and talk about the land? You need to be on the land. He encouraged us to do that, which we did. And it was just so beautiful to be right there on the land, to experience it up close, to see its beauty, and to see that destruction of the placer mining that was going on right beside their hunting camps. It really made me understand the how hard it is for people to see that. You know, it would be like seeing your mother trashed or beaten up or deliberately hurt. Like, that was the feeling that I got from seeing that land and seeing those people and hearing about their experience of seeing that destruction.
What's the place like where your people are from?
Well, my little community is at the northeastern part of Vancouver Island. We are Douglas Treaty people, so we have two treaties that were done in the 1850s, mostly about the protection of hunting and fishing areas, but also village sites. And our community is right on the beach. One of my favorite things is to look at my uncle's Facebook posts, because just about every day he posts a beautiful sunset or a sunrise. And, you know, his place is right on the beach, and, you know, lots of birds and clams. And but again, you know, like, that's a place that could use some revitalizing of Indigenous law, because I don't know how safe it is to harvest clams on that beach anymore. And when I was a child, I,
used to go onto that beach with my grandfather and follow my grandfather on the beach as he dug clams or got crabs. And it's not something that I don't think people can do that anymore because of the pollution from septic fields or gray water or what it is. But I know the beach has been closed to harvesting for many years. And so that's a community that I would love to get the opportunity to revitalize Indigenous law.
I hope you get that chance.
Yeah.
Have you put it on the list?
Well, yeah, I have. And it's just a matter of kind of getting it all to happen. It takes a fair amount of work for the community to do this work. So it's not just us from West Coast Environmental Law coming to do the work in their communities. It also takes a lot of community capacity to even get the work started. And a lot of communities are there's a shortage of people who are available to do the work. They're so busy with doing everything that needs doing, you know, putting food on the table and looking after kids and going to their other jobs. And a lot of communities have capacity problems related to colonization. You know, it's certainly no fault of theirs. It's important to look at the bigger picture to see where that comes from.
So they have to go to jobs, or how's it related to colonization?
You know, there's the whole history of residential schools, and there are either people who are unemployed, or if they are employed, maybe they're employed in resource industries that, you know, there's not that many resource industry jobs anymore, or Just my experience of being in a lot of Indigenous communities is that people are really busy, and anyone who is capable of, you know, doing this kind of work is usually pretty busy doing something else. You know, they're the people that get called upon to volunteer for language work or cultural work or elder care or child care or volunteering in a community garden or preparing for ceremonies. So just that what I see is that people who are capable are usually pretty busy. And then there are a lot of people who are not capable for reasons that, you know, it's not their fault, but it's the fault of colonization that maybe they've ended up just unable to participate fully.
Mm. So is this the kind of work that could be done while tending the garden and the children?
Well, I always think it's important to have children around. I love it when we have kids come to our sessions. I really think that that's one of the it's one of the important aspects of Indigenous pedagogy, is to have children present, because I think that Indigenous law can be learned, you know, not just by, you know, sitting in a classroom or in a workshop somewhere, but it's through living the law, you know. And so kids can learn it by being around other people who are practicing it daily, and, you know, just being there and hearing discussions or hearing languages or participating or preparing for ceremonies or being around when decisions are being made. So yeah, I think children for sure. And I bet you there's something in gardens, too. There's probably some kind of Indigenous law that we can learn by, you know, being out there in nature. Yeah.
Yeah.
Since 2018, the University of Victoria in British Columbia offers a 4-year joint degree program in Canadian common law and Indigenous legal orders. The coursework includes 2 terms of supervised work with Indigenous communities on their lands. Maxine Mattelby is now an Indigenous elder in residence at Vancouver Island University, as well as the program lead for West Coast Environmental Law's ReLaw project, revitalizing Indigenous law for land, air, and water. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning, whose recent salons can be viewed at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle Is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.